Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, the second hour. Welcome back to our telephone talk program in the morning. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in for David Inge this hour. And in our 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about the life and the legacy of someone we don't really know that well, but we know the name really well. At a minute after midnight this morning, 25 people learned that they'll be getting grants of $500,000 apiece to continue and concentrate on the groundbreaking work that they've begun in all sorts of different fields. They're known as the Fellows of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. They're better known, the grants are better known as genius grants. They're given to people who, according to the foundation's president, in his words, work on the very edge of discovery and people at the edge of a new synthesis. The MacArthur Foundation is one of the 10 biggest philanthropies in the United States. It has about $7 billion in endowments, and you even hear it as a frequent underwriter on public radio. But for all the foundation's well-publicized work, the man behind the foundation isn't quite as well-known. In fact, he had little in common with the people who run the foundation, who get all the grants. Nor was philanthropy really a goal of his life. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with someone who has written an unauthorized biography of John D. MacArthur. He built up an empire in insurance, yet he stayed out of the limelight and actually led a relatively modest life while his fortune grew past the billion-dollar mark. Nancy Kriplin is our guest this morning on the show. She researched MacArthur's life for a book called The Eccentric Billionaire, John D. MacArthur, Empire Builder, Reluctant Philanthropist, Relentless Adversary. Nancy Kriplin is a freelance writer. She's based in Indianapolis, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Nancy.
Nice to be with you.
Ah, there you are. Thanks for joining us this morning. And we would like you, the listener, to join us as well in the conversation. If you have questions, give us a call on our lines. They're 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. And the toll-free line is 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Nancy, let's start, first of all, just talking about why we don't know that much about John D. MacArthur. I mean, this is a person who, when he died, was the third richest man in the world. He was up there with Howard Hughes and the Gettys and the Rockefellers, and we know a lot about them, even, you know, Howard Hughes, who had this reclusive life. Well, John D. MacArthur, I don't know if you could call him reclusive, but we just don't know much about him.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? My theory is that we like our moneyed celebrities in this country to have a little bit of glitz. Mm-hmm. We like them to have homes in Newport and to be pretty much high flyers. That's all part of what makes them money celebrities. And John MacArthur didn't live that kind of life. In fact, he was a brother of Charles MacArthur's, who was the playwright and was married to Helen Hayes.
A little bit of stardom in that family, yeah.
Yes, yes. And I have a feeling that John was as much an actor, in a way, as Charles and Helen. I think he liked, toward the end of his life, playing the role of a poor guy who nobody would know. He loved it when people would come into his hotel that he owned down in Florida and think this poor old guy in baggy pants and a torn sweatshirt was a bellboy, and they'd hand him their bags to take up to their room. And he thought that was just great. And of course, here's the second or third richest man in the country, and I bet he kept the tips. He was quite a
miser. We'll talk a little bit more about that, too, and you picked the best picture for the front of the book. It's him in his coffee shop. There's a little coffee shop in the hotel that he owned on this island in Florida, which he also owned, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Well, oh, yeah.
And he's there at the counter with a phone next to him, where apparently he did, you know, the vast majority of his office work late in his life. And there he is pouring himself a cup of coffee. He's got a pack of cigarettes. He looks like your average customer there in the store. And you wouldn't tell from the picture in his, you know, his plaid jacket, you know, no tie, that he was the third richest man in the world, or
exactly,
in the U.S.
Yes, I think, I think he loved it that way. I think there were practical reasons why he ran his business from this coffee shop table. He could get away from people who were trying to borrow $100,000, $200,000 and walk out in the kitchen and hide. And if he had taken them upstairs where he did have an office, it would have been much harder to get rid of him. And, of course, it was cheap, and he was cheap. He could have the girl on the cash register kind of operate as his secretary, and she would sort of shepherd people to his table or not, and she would answer the phone and put through the calls or not. So he loved this role.
Yeah, and he talked about his frugality as part of his Scottish heritage. It's, you know, the stereotypical Scottish budget-mindedness.
That's right. That's how he cloaked it. But I think there was more than that.
He led a very modest life because he led a rough life, or his family did, when he was growing up. Started in Pennsylvania and moved around as his father did.
That's right. Yes, his father was a itinerant, self-ordained fundamentalist preacher, and the family had hard times, and yet four of the boys in the family who grew to adulthood all became millionaires, which I think is pretty remarkable. It's an interesting family.
Why do you think that was the case?
Well, I think they were goaded by the fact that they didn't have money as they were growing up, and they saw how hard it was for their mother to feed them. Senior MacArthur, William, had sort of this airy idea that the Lord will provide, and then he'd run off to save other souls, and he'd leave his wife to try and feed the children and feed all the people that would stop by the house. And I think these boys were all very motivated not to end up like that.
And we note later in the book that although John MacArthur doesn't say much about his father, he does kind of revere his mother in
exactly,
in quotes.
Yes. And she was a Canadian woman named Georgiana Wellstead. She came from a family that was educated, that valued the arts, and she, I think, was the civilizing presence in the MacArthur household. And he was very close to his mother, although I think probably Charlie MacArthur, who was the clever, good student, may have been her favorite. She had a real rapport with Charlie. But John, of course, is the youngest, was still there when she died, and I think he always revered her and thought she had a much finer character than his preacher father.
And we have to mention that they all sort of worked off each other as well, as far as brothers. The first jobs that John MacArthur had were at the behest of his oldest brother, Alfred, who, strangely enough, was in the insurance business, and that's how John MacArthur eventually built his empire.
That's right. And I think that's not unusual with large families. There were seven children originally. One little boy died in a tragic gun accident. Mm-hmm. So there were four boys, two girls who lived to adulthood, and I think you find this. Alfred came out, married, became very successful in his own insurance company, and he lived in Oak Park, and then Charlie came out to the Chicago area, and he lived with Alfred. Then John came out to Chicago area, and he lived with Alfred. And they lived, incidentally, for a time in the old Frank Lloyd Wright house and workshop in Oak Park. So it's quite a historic location
back before the days of historic preservation. It was just maybe just another house, although a unique one with Frank Lloyd Wright's background.
Yes.
We invite you again to give us your phone calls, your thoughts, questions about John D. MacArthur. That's the subject of our Focus 580 Hour today. Nancy Kriplin is our guest. The title of the book is The Eccentric Billionaire, John D. MacArthur, Empire Builder, Reluctant Philanthropist, Relentless Adversary. Our numbers are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Let's take a call in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. Did you do any research on his, I don't know how many children he had, but he had a son who started the Bradford Exchange.
Exactly, John Roderick, right. Yeah. I did do some research on him. Did you ever know Rod?
Well, I'll tell you what, I taught in Chicago at Roosevelt University, and there was a direct marketing program, and I think I actually heard him speak one time. Was he sort of, did he wear bow ties or something or other or not?
I don't know that I've ever seen a photo of him with a bow tie. The picture we have of him in our book is he doesn't have a tie on. But he was He and his father had a very tense relationship. Sometimes they got along, sometimes they didn't. He worked for his dad for a while, but John was hard on him. And in a way, it's interesting because I think they had a lot of the same personality. And Rod had John as an investor when he started the Bradford Exchange. And this is see if I describe this properly. This is a company that markets collector plates. Mm-hmm. And it's a very big and lucrative business. And Rod was, you know, he had a lot of the old man in him, and he made it a success. And so then John said, well, I want more of that money. He had maybe 49%. He said, I want more. And Rod said, no, I'm the one who built it up. You won't get any more. I'll settle with you for, and they named a certain sum. And John said, no. You know, his competitive juices were flowing. So John locked the access to the warehouse where the plates were stored. But somehow Rod was able to get someone to let him in. So these trucks pulled up, and they loaded all these plates into trucks, and he stole away in the night with with all the plates that were, of course, part of this Bradford Exchange. But I mean, that's an amazing story for a father to be that competitive with his child, that they end up with this huge, dramatic event. I'm glad you asked about that, because it was really quite a contest between the two of them.
Well, I also understand, and the other part of the story that I heard was that he actually sued his son, because what he said was that while he was working for him in the insurance company, that he was working on developing the Bradford Exchange.
Right, right. That sounds like John. John had lawsuits going all the time. One time he showed up in New York. They were honoring him for ransoming the ruby that had been stolen from the American Museum of Natural History. So he went up there for a presentation, and he stepped out of the hotel, and a process server handed him a paper. And so he and his wife, Catherine, couldn't go to this event, so Helen Hayes went ahead and represented him. But he loved to sue people. He hated lawyers, but he loved to sue people, and people loved to sue him.
The other one is that he was a big advocate of this whole positive thinking thing, or whatever they call that. Do you remember that, or was that in there too?
You know, I never came across very much about that, but I know he believed strongly in hard work, and he, you know, those are some of the pluses on his side. He was up even when he was in his 70s. He was up at 5:30 in the morning calling his real estate guy in New York and seeing who was in trouble, who needed a loan, because John always had a lot of cash, and that's how he made his a lot of money. If you missed your payment on your mortgage on your new hotel or shopping center by a couple minutes after midnight, boy, it belonged to John.
I look forward to the program.
Yes, he was something.
And thanks for your call. And if you do have a question, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And you mentioned, you know, his son's founding of the Bradford Exchange is just another example of you found something that just isn't being done, and just that knack for finding something that will eventually make money. This is a place that did, like, bicentennial plates in
exactly,
in the 1970s.
And that's how he started. He had spent time – we're talking about Rod now,
right,
his son.
Right.
And he had spent time in France, and his wife was French, so he had connections there, and he decided that Americans would snap up French porcelain plates that honored heroes of the American Revolution in 1776, and it was wildly successful. And I think that's what John noticed, and he thought, I want a piece of that action.
Yeah. How did John start? He went to found his own insurance company, and the story behind that is interesting as well. But you know, what is it about John MacArthur where he was able to find, you know, unmet need, or at least, you know, persuade people to buy things from him, essentially to give him money, and that's how, you know, Bankers Life and Casualty, his company, was founded.
As you said, he got started working for his older brother, Alfred.
Right.
Well, Alfred was a typical older brother, and he was pretty stern and wanted John to toe the line, and so there was just some normal sibling friction there, I think. But Alfred claimed also John would go out and sell policies and promise people things that, that weren't in the policy at all. So he finally decided John was not to be trusted, and he told him he should leave. So after he had fired John, John, of course, knew the business, and he bought a little company that was struggling over in Jerseyville, Illinois, and it was called Marquette Life. Mm-hmm. And so that gave him kind of a toehold in his own business. He worked for somebody else for a while, but he was very outspoken, and he would, you know, tell them they didn't know how to run the business. So pretty soon he realized he had to make a go of insurance, which was the only thing he knew. He had quit school after the ninth grade. So then someone told him one day that there was, that we're talking about the early days of the Great Depression, early 1930s, and he heard that there was a small company named Bankers Life and Casualty that was going to be put out of business. And so he said to the insurance examiner, how much would it take to take over that company? And he said, $2,500. Well, John didn't have that kind of money, but he knew somebody who he could borrow it from, a man named Leo Lahan, who was his friend, had worked for Alfred, and he lent John the money along with some other people. So John snapped up Bankers Life and Casualty.
And Leo Lahan became one of his cohorts
You're right. And then he discovered that though the company, the people who had owned it before had run it into the ground, they did have a good idea. They would sell policies for $1, $2, $5, whatever a working man happened to have in his pocket. And this was not done by the big insurance company players at the time. And so that he started picking up policies from people who couldn't afford to pay for a regular policy. And then he got the idea of selling insurance by mail. And this was really looked down upon by the other established insurance companies. So he would send out mailers. Pretty soon he was advertising it everywhere, and the returns were huge. And he realized that he had, as you say, struck something that wasn't being done by anybody else in the country, and that's what really made Bankers Life and Casualty take off.
How interesting that, you know, he would start his career by doing direct mail in a place where there hadn't been direct mail before, and
exactly.
His son would do the same thing 40, 50 years later.
And at one point, it seems to me the U.S. Post Office's substation at the Bankers Life and Casualty headquarters was larger than any of the others, even of Sears Roebuck in town, because he was sending and receiving so much mail.
Let's talk a little about, you know, the founding of the company in Chicago and his history, starting with that little company that you first talked about, the Marquette Life Insurance Company. He moved that to Chicago, you mentioned, and in a bit of marketing genius, he put it in the Marquette building in Chicago.
Isn't that interesting? And I went to check the old records over in Springfield of the insurance examiners, and absolutely, it was named Marquette probably before John bought it. So I still am not sure how he could afford an office in the Marquette building right there in the Loop. It's a gorgeous building. I don't know whether your listeners have seen it. It's got beautiful murals in the lobby of Père Marquette, who was the French explorer in Illinois. And but John didn't have any money. We're in the Depression. So he was only there a year, and then his office moved to another probably cheaper location.
And that was an old bank, I guess, that
eventually
went up.
Yes, eventually he decided to move out to a bank building in an area of Chicago on the near west side called Mayfield, and it's a very modest neighborhood.
Right.
And so that's where he set up shop, and Catherine sat right by the door so she could keep her eye on everything. She was a very shrewd businesswoman, and she was not at all this dowager with pearls whom I had always envisioned sort of being very philanthropic.
Because her name is right up there with the foundation, right?
Yes, right. And then when he would need more buildings, he would add on apartment buildings in the neighborhood. He would buy empty supermarkets or florist shops. He had one of his parts of his business upstairs over a bar, and the bar was still functioning. I think working for John, that probably sent people down to get a drink every once in a while. And it was a hodgepodge. I talked to people who had called on the company when it was there, and they said, you cannot believe this company. The ceilings were so low because, you know, he would be very unartistic in how he linked all these buildings together. These were no architectural gems. Mm-hmm. The ceilings were so low in some parts of the building that he hired dwarfs as maintenance men. And somebody said, you know, it was some sight to see these guys going through the building at night with their sacks hung over their shoulders. You wanted to whistle hi-ho or something. They said it was just amazing.
But it's amazing that, you know, in as that company grew so much that they stayed in that building and sort of made do with what they had.
You bet.
Instead of going out and buying a flashy new building.
That's
this,
right.
This just goes back to John MacArthur's, you know, his frugality. You also talk about Catherine T. MacArthur. Explain a little about how their marriage came to be, how she started working for him, and that led to that. But Catherine was his second wife.
Exactly. He married a well-brought-up Oak Park girl named Louise. And the pictures I've seen of John in that era, he was very dashing. And we have a picture in the book of John and his World War One Army uniform. And I think he had little, you know, this personality. I'm sure he attracted Louise because her family did not approve. And so she was sort of swept off her feet. So they eloped. They had two children, John Roderick, whom we mentioned, and a daughter, Virginia. But at that point, he was still working for Alford, and he caught the eye of, or she caught his eye, this cute teenage secretary named Catherine Therese. And that's a good trivia question. What's the T for, and what's the D for, and John D. Donald?
Okay.
Anyway, Catherine was working for Alfred, but somehow or other, she decided to run off with this brash, fast-talking, good salesman, and so they ran off together, and she was very helpful to him all the way through the insurance business because she was had good ideas, and she was a good detail person, so they made quite a pair.
Yeah, she was about as influential in the company as he was.
Well, she was certainly very influential.
Back in those days when...
Yes.
You know, women normally didn't take that role.
And, you know, and she kept all the memos I found are signed Catherine Therese Highland, or C.T. Highland. She didn't use the MacArthur name a lot.
Because she, you know, she wanted to be his...
I think so, yes, yes. Yeah. She wanted to maintain her own personality and her own individuality, and I think she probably thought, well, this is a little more businesslike.
But even that marriage was troubled in a couple of different situations. First of all, there was an overlap as far as his divorce to Louise.
That's a nice way to put it, an overlap.
It's a 12, what was it, a 12-year overlap, I
yep.
think, wasn't
yep,
it?
Yep, yep.
And they had a brief separation that you know, probably cemented their relationship going on past that.
It was very stormy. And, of course, John liked the ladies all his life. And he was a pincher. When girls would go to work for Bankers Life and Casualty, they were told, okay, if you don't want the boss to be pinching and groping, keep your distance from him. And that was just his personality. Well, I think probably Catherine at some point had enough. Or maybe it was she knew everything that had gone on that company. Maybe there were some financial or legal problems buried under a rock that she knew about. But anyway, she had enough. So she decided to move out, and pretty soon she wanted her share, and he said, well, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. We were never legally married anyway, because he hadn't gotten a legal divorce from Louise. So she said, is that right? So she was very sharp, as I said, and she hired a good divorce lawyer, and she realized that since she'd never been legally married, she could testify against John. And that's the only reason we have a record of some of his operations, because of the court papers that were filed as part of this divorce action. But finally, a judge said to him, you know, this is a case of too much money and too many lawyers. Why don't you two go off together and see if you can't patch things up? So they did. And they then were together more or less happily the rest of their lives.
Our guest this morning is Nancy Kriplin. She's the author of the book, The Eccentric Billionaire. It's a biography of John D. MacArthur. You've heard of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is the person who began it. We have Nancy to talk to us about John D. MacArthur's life. And your calls are welcome, 333-9455, outside the local calling area, 1-800-222-9455. Nancy, there's a lot talked about in the book about John MacArthur's business dealings with Banker's Life, and I don't want to say, you know, he was a completely shady, unethical character, but there were times when the practices would sort of push the borders.
Well, that's very true, and I think again, John loved this, and insurance is regulated state by state, so there is no overarching federal agency keeping check of insurance, and particularly in those days, and we're talking about the 1930s, 1940s, he would do something, and they would say, you can't do that, and he'd say, oh, yes, I can, and then they'd pass a law in Illinois that he couldn't. So he was ahead of them most of the way, but he liked that, in my opinion. He liked that sort of drama with his company.
Mm-hmm. And it did lead to some investigations here and there. Is there a reason why, and I've noticed this a couple times, even to this day, even though Banker's Life has moved on, it's become part of another company,
sure,
but they don't do business in New York. And it mentioned in the book that they didn't do business at the time of his death in like California and New York and another large state.
Right.
Is there a particular reason for that?
Well, yeah. They figured that he wasn't. They looked at his record of paying claims and they thought, we don't want him. At one time, about 14 states that were places in which Banker's Life and Casualty Business held a big conference to figure out what they could do about John MacArthur. But he usually stayed just this side of what was legal. I was talking to a friend in Indianapolis when I was working on the book, and this friend's family had been in the insurance business for a long time. And he said, who are you working on? And I told him, and he said, that crook? And I thought, you know, and that's the way some people saw him. Now, on the other hand, his employees were very loyal. He was a terrific salesman, and he always knew how important salesmen were to his company. So he would have big events, contests for him, and they were very loyal to him and to the product that John sold.
I was going to say, it's, you know, with even with the the weird working arrangements in the main office, these are people who did not, you know, they really respected the man.
That's right. And there is still a group of people, we're jumping ahead a little bit.
Uh-huh.
After he went to Florida, there are still a group of his old cronies that get together once a year on March the 6th, which was his birthday, to toast their old pal, MacArthur. And I think that's pretty amazing, because I know some very admirable, upright people, and nobody remembers them 30 years after their death.
Now, and this was also interesting in that he was in one of the rare cases, I guess, in which John MacArthur was ahead of his time and maybe presaged, you know, the good things that the MacArthur Foundation does, is that Banker's Life was one of the few companies that that hired people with disabilities.
That's right. And, you know, with John, you're never sure of the motive. Somebody said to me, yeah, but you know you could get government funds if you were hiring the handicapped. I'm not sure you could at the time he was doing this, but I think these people were grateful to have a job, and he didn't think anybody should not be hired. It didn't matter about their age or their handicap. And I talked to people who had worked in the Banker's Life offices in Chicago, and they said, this man told me he learned to sign because so many of his colleagues were deaf, and he said you had to watch where you stepped so you didn't step on a seeing-eye dog. So that is an aspect of John that really is very admirable.
And there wasn't any, I mean, there was no overt reason why he did that?
I think it was because this is a willing workforce. I don't know whether he paid them the same amount he paid everybody else, and I don't know whether he did get some sort of state or government funding rebates because of that. But it was also good publicity. Eleanor Roosevelt used to write this column, My Day, you know, and she went out and visited and wrote about this man out in Chicago that is hiring the handicapped. So it was very good publicity, and I think it was going against the normal employment practices, and boy, did John love to do that.
All right. Our guest is Nancy Kriplin, and the subject is The Life of John D. MacArthur. Let's go take a call now in Sullivan. Good morning.
Yes. Curiosity, what part of Florida did he live in?
He, and most of his land was on the East Coast, and the Colonnades Hotel, which is on Singer Island. Do you know that area?
Yes.
It's the island just north of Palm Beach, and that's where he finally settled, and that's where this table that Tom was talking about, from which he ran his business in the coffee shop, was located. At one time, I think he owned most of Palm Beach County. And he was the one who founded and nourished Palm Beach Gardens, although they have their own wonderful MacArthur stories to tell about the many fights and disagreements they got together with him. But I think he was very proud of Palm Beach Gardens. He liked having places for people to live. He thought Florida was really a golden state, and that was the area in which he settled.
Yeah, I didn't know. I've been down there many a time, and there's always McCarthy Dairy.
No, that's a different family.
It is a different family.
Yes, yes, that's a different family. But John MacArthur, I don't know, do you know John D. MacArthur State Park that's over on the north end of Singer Island? That was his land. And then he had a dairy, a farm in the center of the state near Lake Placid, on Highway 70 north of Okeechobee.
Yes,
and he loved that place. And that was a working cattle and citrus farm.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you.
And, thank you.
And thanks for your call. Let's talk a little about, you know, why did John D. MacArthur move his operation to Florida? I mean, was it like everybody else? He liked the sunshine and warm winters?
But John, I think,
he had money in mind, too.
Yeah, I think with John, first of all, it was about money. You know, life insurance companies have a lot of cash that they have to invest because they've got to be ready to pay claims. And so some people to whom he had loaned money, Carl Beyer was one of them, a hotshot PR guy from New York, Ralph Stolkin, they owned land that had once belonged to Sir Harry Oakes in the northern part of Palm Beach County. And they missed their payments and couldn't do anything about it, and so John took it over. And when he went down there to look at his land, he thought, wow. You know, he said that we're talking about the middle 1950s, and he thought that he had very good land sense, someone told me. And he thought Florida was about to boom again, and he wanted to be a part of it. So he kept expanding his holdings, and by the time he died, he was the largest single individual landowner in Florida. Most of it was in Palm Beach County. He owned all the way up to Jupiter and then inland. And but he did own some. He bought some tracts from the Ringling Estate over on the West Coast in Sarasota. And when I was there, I asked what had happened to it. And the county has taken over that land, so it's now a public park and hiking area.
Is it named after MacArthur?
No, I don't think it carries a MacArthur name. A lot of things do in over on the East Coast, but I don't think that tract at this point is named MacArthur anything.
Yeah. One of the things that he was involved in not long after he moved there was the possibility of when Walt Disney wanted to build his big East Coast Florida amusement park, John D. MacArthur was in on that too eventually, but lost, a rare loss.
Yes, he... His people contacted Disney when they knew what was up. Again, John had good abilities to sniff the wind and see when there might be something coming up. And he and Walt apparently hit it off very well. There's one rumor that he took Walt skinny dipping on MacArthur's, what is now MacArthur State Park, but at that part was a place on the beach called Air Force Beach, and it was informally considered a nudist beach. Well, John was a great swimmer, liked to swim, and who knows whether that actually happened. Well, when the time, and he and Walt had a handshake deal, when it time to pin down the details on this, Roy Disney, who was the money man in the Disney operation, was running the show, and he started asking for more things than John and Walt had originally agreed on, and John got up and walked out of the meeting. He said, a handshake is a handshake, and that's the way I do business, and I'm not going to sit here and mess with these guys anymore. As it turned out, this was something John wanted to bring into the area near Palm Beach Garden,
right,
bring in tourists. But the Disney operation had kind of gotten stung out in California because they didn't own enough land to benefit from all the subsidiary companies, motels, restaurants that would spring up around the park. And they decided, boy, they'd never get into that mess again. So they needed more land, really, than John had. And that's one reason the Orlando location was much more appropriate for him.
Nancy Kriplin is our guest. We're talking about John D. MacArthur of the Foundation fame. And our numbers are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to a call this morning, in Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning. I have kind of a simple sort of question, I'm sure. Is Douglas related to all these MacArthurs in any way?
No, and that's a very interesting question, because when I was looking up stuff about the MacArthur family to see what had been written, I kept running into Douglas. The family, particularly one of John's older brothers, Telfer, who ran for political office, liked to claim that they were cousins of Douglas's. And even John said he was and was promoting Douglas for president. But a historian from a university who did a lot of background checking said there's no connection other than back in the mists of Scotland, way too anciently for anybody to really document.
So if it had been a cousin, it had been so far back, I could have been related to him.
Exactly, exactly. After all, what, 5 degrees of separation, whatever that is. Now, John knew MacArthur and was in his suite at the time in Chicago when it looked like MacArthur might get the nod as the Republican nominee. But and of course, they would have been delighted to have had MacArthur's backing. He and Henry Luce were both trying to get MacArthur Douglas to run for president. I was down in Miami one time, and I saw the MacArthur Causeway, and I thought, wow, you know, MacArthur's a big Florida name. Maybe that's name for John. It's not. It's name for the general.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for your call. Something that I thought about even before I hit that part of the book. But there's no relation except for their political leanings. John D. MacArthur was a very conservative person for that time.
Exactly. And he said one time to a reporter, do you realize how different this country would be if MacArthur had been president? And he would have been very happy with that because he was a rock-rib conservative Republican.
How then did we get to the point of the MacArthur Foundation, which, you know, supports things that I wonder what John D. would have thought about that if he knew what this was supporting. Explain a little about how it came to be that he put this money aside, and it wasn't necessarily for philanthropy. In fact, he wasn't too crazy about the word philanthropist.
That's right, and that's such a good question. His estate, his lawyer told him, was a mess. And his lawyer had been trying, he was a smart Chicago lawyer named Bill Kirby, and he had been trying to get John to think about what would happen after he died for a long time, but he wasn't able to do it. So he finally, and I've got a scene in the book where Bill Kirby is flown to the ranch to meet with John MacArthur, And they sit on the front porch of this very modest ranch house and talk and talk and talk. And he said to John, you know what's going to happen? The government is going to tear up your businesses in order to have the cash to pay all the taxes. Well, the one thing that John hated more than the word philanthropy was government taxes. And so he finally agreed that this foundation could be set up. So in October of 1970, Bill Kirby flew back down to Florida, and he went upstairs to this kitchen table in the MacArthur's apartment there in this tacky hotel, the Colonnades Hotel, and they sat down at the table, and he had drawn up the papers, and John had looked at them, and so he was ready to sign, and it said the John D. MacArthur Foundation, and he said, let's put Catherine's name in there. She's helped build it up. So she took the papers and went off and typed it up as John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And I thought, you know, for all of his wandering ways and his crooked schemes, that was one of his fine moments, in my opinion, because that was one of the early foundations where the husband and wife's name both were included.
But he didn't really have a say in how the money was to be spent,
he said what he liked to say was, I'm going to do what I do best, which is make money. You fellows can decide after I'm gone how to spend it.
Yeah, I have a quote here that I can read that he mentioned, in an interview with somebody else. I've seen too many people, including Henry Ford, try to administer their estates from the grave. You have changing times. Besides, you lay down rules and people don't follow them. So I'll trust to the Almighty that my trustees will do more good for the country than I would.
I mean, and this was after I think he had kind of gotten used to the idea that his money was going to go for gas philanthropy, and he'd mellowed a little bit about that, but that's a great quote, isn't it? And that's one of the few times I have ever seen that he mentioned the Almighty in any way. His father would have been delighted. But anyway, the foundation then didn't come into existence until, as was the plan, until after John died, and that was in January of 1978. He'd had a stroke, he had cancer of the pancreas, he was a lifelong chain smoker, and it all caught up with him, and so he died in 78 in West Palm Beach in the hospital there. And it wasn't then until later that year in August that Bill Kirby, who was with the foundation, brought in this idea of having these genius awards. Would you like for me to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, let's talk about that, since they just awarded another batch of them this year. But that's what the foundation is known most for. And I've looked at some of the people who have won, and you know, these are projects that I don't know if John D. MacArthur would have invested in himself. But
that's right. And you know, I was speaking to a group the other night, and a man stood up who had sold IBM machines to MacArthur, and he knew him, and he said, I don't think he'd approve of any of this stuff that the foundation is doing. But, you know, you never know. Some of them are quirky enough that John just might have liked them, but he was opposed to the whole idea of giving away money. He thought people ought to have to make their own money, and, of course, that's what his son did. He made his own fortune with the Bradford Exchange. But then this Kirby brought this article to the board, and it was an editorial that had appeared in the American Heart Institute Journal, and it was written by a man named Dr. George Birch, and he said, we ought to give good minds the space to think and to come up with good things. He said, can I read just a couple lines from his original editorial? Americans should be financially able and wise enough to provide a few people with $35,000 to $40,000 per year. Of course, now it's up to a lot more than that, to do whatever research they want, alone, free from frustration, to think, to delve into the unknown, to satisfy their curiosity. Can't we Americans afford to gamble a little on a few real scientists? Who are the peers of Fleming, Madame Curie, Newton? We need to be able to give these people enough security and minimal support and leave them alone in peace to think, observe, and study without having to spend valuable time giving an account of themselves with reports, applications, lectures, and publications. We need to support thinking in the best minds of Americans. Remember, the strength of America resides in the minds of Americans. This was the call to arms, sort of, that Kirby brought to the board of the foundation. And this, again, was 7 months after MacArthur had died. Mm-hmm. And they didn't make their first grant until early 1981.
And these are grants that, you know, just like that article had said, there aren't strings attached to them.
Right. That's the thing that's
amazing. You get the money and you do what you do.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, who knows what MacArthur would think of this. I think it's always a mistake to think that people who thought one way when they were alive wouldn't have been influenced by conditions and might not be thinking in slightly different ways. Now, I think, he knew the value of publicity, so he would like some of this. I'm sure there are some of that would not match his political agenda. And the interesting thing is the grants are only about 5% of the money that the foundation gives in grants every year, but they are certainly the best known.
Right. It's more of a traditional foundation in some of those other senses.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. How much did Catherine have, how much of a say did she have over the guidance of the foundation? You mentioned she died about four years after he did.
Yes. I'm not sure Catherine Rose, he put her as one of the people he would want on the board, along with Rod. He said, you'll have plenty of fights, but I think you ought to have Rod on there. Bill Kirby, some of the other people from Banker's Life and Casualty executives. I'm not sure she ever had much influence at all. Catherine was sort of a recluse, it seems to me, at the end of her life. She one of the wives of the executives at Banker's Life took her into Palm Beach to shop at those very fancy stores, and she was intimidated by the sales lady, and she said, oh, I've never been in one of these stores before. Well, here she was. She could have bought the whole town, island of Palm Beach probably, but she was very uncomfortable with that. She collected Lalique and Chinese porcelains, but she would have the dealers come to her there in the colonnades and show her their wares, and you think, what? That's no fun to shop like that. So I think she was very hesitant to have much of a public figure.
And even in the philanthropic department, his tumultuous relationship with his only son Rod also surfaced as well. One thing that came to mind was this school of music or drama. I remember at Florida State University that began sort of foundered.
Right. Yes. Now that was something that I don't think Rod had much of a presence in that. That was something that John wanted to do in honor of his brother Charlie, the playwright.
Okay. Right.
I think Charlie genuinely loved. I don't think there were a lot of people in his life that he generally liked or loved, but Charlie was the brother closest to him, and he loved him. And he was approached by a professor down there who knew Helen Hayes, that it would be appropriate to have a Center for the American Theater named for Charles MacArthur. So this was all set up to take place at the Florida State University in Tallahassee. Well, John went to several events there. They were collecting scripts and various memorabilia, not only from Charlie MacArthur, but from the history of early theater.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of Yiddish theater stuff. It was a fine collection. Well, when John died, these people were all under the assumption that John was going to take care of them after he died. He put a lot of money into it while he was still living. Well, he made no provisions for him in his will. So they were just stunned. And that collection then was disbanded, and I finally found it in an old warehouse up in Tallahassee, and nobody knew these boxes were there. And I found some transcriptions of tapes that John had done, and that was, again, very, very useful for my research. But these people were stunned. John didn't think much about what he would do with his money after he was gone.
yet that's what he's best known for at this moment. It's those ironies, I guess, that made him such an interesting character to explore, I guess. What did you get out of this?
That's what I got. I did find some things to admire about John. He was a hard worker. He didn't believe in just sitting around and playing golf once you retired. He kind of looked down at his nose at people in Palm Beach who just lived the high life. I kind of like it that he didn't put on airs, although he carried it to extremes, certainly. Mm-hmm. He'd never fly first class. He'd always fly coach because he said the back end of the plane gets there just as soon as the front end of the plane. And he figured he'd be a bad example for his salesman if he started flying around the country first class. I also like the way, that he put Catherine's name on the foundation.
Right.
And I think he had some admirable qualities. And I think that there are other, and then there were some cautionary things. While I was working on the book, everyone, I'd think, oh boy, I'm behind, I've got to keep going. And yet it would be a family birthday, and I'd think, nope, I've seen what happens to somebody who puts family last, and I'm going to make time and have bake a birthday cake and have family birthday party. So in a way, he
was an un-MacArthur-like schedule.
Yes, a reverse instructor on some of this.
All right. Nancy Kriplin has been our guest this hour. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you.
Very interesting book. Very interesting character, too. The name of the book, again, is The Eccentric Billionaire, John D. MacArthur, Empire Builder, Reluctant Philanthropist, and Relentless Adversary. The publisher is Amacom, and that book is on sale now, on this day that the MacArthur Genius Grants were announced in Chicago.